Congratulations. You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast with me, Kate Rhodes, and Maysoon Waswas, who is now back from her international voyage. So she's going to be back on the show next week. Oh my God. Okay. Shout out to the guy at the info desk at SF MoMA who was very weirded out by me trying to get in on a press pass, I think because I was in a hoodie covered in paint, but next time I'll wear my blazer. Apologies / not apologies to SF MoMA. Okay, got a couple announcements before we get to our rock star interview today. Vanguard Revisited, Poetic Politics and Black Futures is already open. It opened on Tuesday, January 22nd, but the reception is January 26th from 5 to 8 p.m. Okay, and that is over at SFAI in the Walter McBean Gallery. Is it Walter and McBean? Anyhow, that was curated by Layla Weaver. It includes some stellar artists like Keisha Lucas, Tasha Steimage, Five Fifths Collective, and Chris Martin. And those contemporary Bay Area artists are working in concert with archival photographs, I think of the Black Panther Party back in the day. This exhibition of contemporary work assembles a new understanding of the Black political imagination to disrupt the assumption that activism needs to be aggressive or didactic. They employ symbolism associated with Black radical traditions, making space for nuance and complexity. Okay, get over to that show. It's going to be awesome. Also, if you like last week's episode with Sarah Tebow, she's got a thing coming up at Royal Nonsuch Gallery. The Cliterary Salon. It's a monthly literary show focusing on work not traditionally prioritized in the mainstream by writers who subvert convention, including Meg Ellison and Maggie Takuda Hall. They're going to be the MCs for the evening. And Sarah Tebow's going to be reading a new essay. There's going to be all kinds of stuff going on. If you want to RSVP to that, there'll be a link for it in the underworld. Okay, here we go. Get into the interview. Enjoy it. Okay, we're out here in beautiful San Francisco, California, in the haunted film studio of San Francisco Art Institute, talking to artist Amy Balkin.
Thanks for having me.
Yay.
Glad to be here.
Hooray. Okay, I think part of the reason that we really needed you on the show at this time is because so much of your work is about climate change and the environment, and we're really hitting a wall here with our time left to be able to do anything about it, huh? And so how fucked are we, and what are we going to do?
Yeah, I wish I could answer that in one sentence, and I actually wish I could be the person to answer that for you, but, you know, I think the thing for me, you know, I've been thinking about climate change and making work about it for a really long time now, from when it seemed like actually there was no work about climate change, and it just seemed to be missing entirely. So now there's just so much material and so much reports, and I think in some ways, you know, we're in sort of the opposite position where we have this kind of, as you could say, like the fire hose of information. But what does that mean in terms of action? And that's a political question, right?
Yes.
So for me, I think the question is, you know, what does it mean to be an artist or a practitioner who's dealing with that? It seemed like a while ago there was this question about, for some people, or projects like Cape Farewell, which is an ongoing project and one of the first ones to bring artists, scientists, and others together in an interdisciplinary way up to the Arctic to see firsthand the effects of climate change and to, you know, spread the word through various media. Things have changed, and maybe that, you know, there's a different time. And so what does that mean in terms of what people are doing, what people are thinking, and what are the implications, and what does it mean to be a practitioner who's thinking about those questions? And I think, you know, at the time I started doing that work, also too, climate justice hadn't really congealed as a kind of movement or come into common parlance or developed as a global movement, also thinking about issues of justice and also, reparations in terms of what's happening. So I think, times have changed a lot, and so that's a question for me. And so what does that mean for what I'm doing? And I think that is a question that I continue to grapple with as I'm continuing to think about questions and make work. And so one of the things I'm broadly interested in is not just climate change, but its impacts on human health, but also, too, the questions about extinction, which are obviously inseparable. And I think, there are so many great people who are writing thoughtfully, making wonderful work, and really tackling the questions of extinction. And, the thing is, there's really an ecology of practices, and there's room for lots of people to be making very succinct statements. And so, and I know I'm a little bit all over the place, but I think the question is, there's all of this work. There's a fire hose of information. What are the implications? What do people expect work to do? Which is a different question than what is motivating artists and other practitioners in terms of how they're developing their own thinking against this whole timeline where emissions are racing. I think I read recently a runaway freight train, right? That's where we're at.
Higher than ever.
Right. So, and in terms of the
Isn't
time,
that crazy?
Yeah, that, it is crazy. And I think, you can hear these kind of polarized, positions there are some things that are, in terms of tipping points, for example, the Greenland ice sheet, we may be reaching tipping point here, or what kind of scenarios are we seeing, or what kind of species loss, and how are these things how are these things going to affect human survivability, which is not the only question. But on the other hand, this idea that, you can't, right, if you didn't plant a tree yesterday, you should plant one today. And not
truly,
literally. Well, yeah, literally, but also
I literally need to plant a tree.
Well, you could, and that's not going to solve it, but I think also,
but that's figuratively,
we didn't act before, so there's no other option back now, right? But so to talk about this thing, there's also the question of, reception, people making work, people thinking about it, lots of material. Lots of other things happening politically, right?
Mm-hmm.
That are ideologically also pushing climate change in some ways, into regressive dialogues at the same time. For example, I think I was just reading yesterday, and now more than ever, at least here in the United States, Americans increasingly acknowledge climate change at the highest number of years, and also increasingly see in those halls as it impacting their everyday lives. And
yes.
So, I think this is so. That said, so what does it mean to be making work or thinking about this in an ongoing way? And I think there's also a question about institutions. What is the role of institutions, or what is the role of work outside of institutions? So you see artists working in institutions, you see artists, and I guess I'm just talking about artists mostly, because that's really where I'm coming from. And also, too, the problems, the ongoing problems of institutions. So, for example, there are great people in the broader Bay Area, like TJ Demos at UC Santa Cruz, who's writing really about the political ecology of climate change, and also analyzing practices for a really long, I guess what I consider to be for a long time and with great depth. And so one of the things he did a number of years ago was also take a survey of survey exhibitions on climate change. And in some ways, it seems to be, and this is just my reading, not his, you do it, it's your thematic thing, and then you're done with it, and it doesn't necessarily require a kind of institutional re-envisioning of what does it mean to have an institution. The institution sees itself as a little ship that survives climate change. It can deal with it as a topic and then move on to other topics, right? And then, of course, this question, which has been addressed, and is being continued to be addressed by groups like Liberate Tate, this question of who's funding museums,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
So this kind of, and there are really good groups like the Natural History Museum with Becca Eck. I think it's Econopolis, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name. I really regard the work. So this work that they're doing, critiquing museums, natural history museums mostly, but also, the fundings like the Koch brothers.
Fuck yeah, the motherfucking Koch brothers.
But it's not the first time you've heard of them, I take it.
Yep.
And hope, maybe the last, one might hope. So I think the question is what does it mean for things to continue on this way? And, a couple of years ago, for example, I was nominated for the SICA Award at the SF MoMA.
Yeah.
And I said, it was right as Trump was in the, I think it was either right before or right after the election. I said, Well, for my project, I'd like you to break your ties with, I think it was Wells Fargo and Bank of America.
And because, Charles Schwab gave $1 million to his inauguration.
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, so, but not necessarily specifically about that, but yes, and I agree, but I think there was this question about they were funding the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so, like, what does this mean for them to invite work like mine and for me to do something, and what's not diminished, and what could be like a win for the institution in terms of it standing behind, you know, the attitudes of the work it's presenting. And, you know, that was an informal thing, and I think there's a question about, like, you know, what is the kind of role of an individual artist versus artists who are networked, artists who are working, you know, together with other kinds of groups for climate action, and what are the limits and sort of what you can seek from an institution?
Yeah.
And, you know, you might say that these institutions tend to be regressive, and that's not something that's not, you know, unknown, right? Mm-hmm. So I think, so there are these questions then about, like, so TJ Demos, what are the limits of the exhibition? What are the limits of the institution? You know, can those change? And is that where people want to put their energy, right?
Right.
So, and I think other kinds of autonomous practices or other kinds of practices that are working side by side, you know, or in parallel with, you know, organizing can do good work that doesn't necessarily kind of get stuck in these kind of institutional critique problems or things that might be political dead ends. But I would also say, like, you have to look at Liberate Tate as being, I think, successful, you know, and work of organizations that, you know, for example, in the UK, an organization I really respect a lot, Platform, you know, so, you know, not to and many artists and organizations here, you know, focusing on the sort of history of oil extraction, and you know, you see good work about that in Canada, mm-hmm. too, as well as around the world. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's a long answer to your first question. I don't even know if I answered it, but
well, it's crazy town.
It's crazy town now,
and so you
know,
yeah.
And so I think there are also these questions about, like, you know, affect, or uh-huh. how can you feel, or how do you know, or what are you?
Or like, is violence the answer?
Right. Well, that's a fair enough question in terms of, well, I mean, what kind of violence are you specifically proposing?
I don't know.
I would say, you know, violence is coming out of climate change,
yeah,
right?
Totally.
You talk about, you know, like different kinds of migrations and the violence of hardened borders in Europe mm-hmm. and the United States and the way that, you know, migration and climate migration is only going to increase. And so I think
totally.
This question about, like, what do guerrilla tactic mean historically? So, like,
yeah.
am I going to advocate for violence? No, but I think that, you know, if you know, what does it mean then to have the foundations of habitability be destroyed, and what comes out of that in terms of increasing despair, right?
Yeah.
At the kind of politics that are permitting that to happen in an ongoing way. Not saying that there aren't a lot of good people. Also, working at a policy level, I guess it depends on where your politics break down. Like, how do you orient yourself in terms of, for example, questions of reform or revolution? You know, do you
yeah.
think that things are, do you think that in terms of the timeline we're looking at, are states capable of addressing these? Or if not, you know, if there are other kinds of processes, are those going to produce that kind of change? Or what kind of timelines do those look like? And I think, you know, so it's, you know, for me, it's, I don't necessarily have the background to address those questions, although, you know, I appreciate how you're entering it. You know, like, so, but would I like a peaceful world? You know, do
yes.
I advocate for violence per se as like a go-to? Not
probably
at all.
Not. Okay,
but,
good.
You know, okay. I don't know. I think you were actually asking me that, but.
Sometimes I think that we have to do that, maybe drastic measures are necessary.
Well, drastic
but
measures
then I'm
are
also
necessary.
Like, or will they just, I mean, drastic in terms of.
Right. Well, I'm not gonna propose that on a podcast.
But then I'm like, but the backlash, but the backlash from that would probably be much worse than, like, it wouldn't come to solutions.
But you know,
listeners don't do
yeah,
anything
okay.
crazy.
Let's segue from that.
One of your projects that you did a reading of the IPCC synthesis report back, that was in like 2008, right? Or around that?
Yeah, you know, well, I've done a number of them. So, you know, and one of the
IPCC is who just put out the one that was like 12 years max, pals. Is that right? Is that the same organization?
There are UNFCCC reports, and there's also information, you know, coordinated by the IPCC.
So
I think I'm not sure the specifics of it, but I can tell you that one of the things that, so in 2008, I think I read the 2007 summary for policymakers, and I've also done a number of other readings, trying to read a publicly read a report for mitigation, which is a much longer document, in a public reading, and doing other kinds of reading projects, and also other people have facilitated readings in different contexts. So I guess the question is, like, you know, what does it mean to think about reading or re-speaking these documents?
And I mean, was part of the kind of impetus to do that was that, like, people aren't going to read this on their own?
Well, that was the impetus, and I think the question is, you know, this idea that there's a kind of opacity to the processes, even if the documents are ostensibly public. And again, I think, you know, I don't want to go back to this like fire hose of data, because I think that that's in some ways, you know, it's an easy idea that, okay, there's too much, we can't make sense of it, what we can do, a kind of like a moral panic around information. But at the same time, I think it's really helpful to sort of take time out of something that you might never read, but at the same time is being used to make determinations about what might happen, but also to understand that those are documents that come out of processes. They're not necessarily, you know, as all information has political turns, these have political turns. Reading them, it's very surprising. Well, for the mitigation report, there was a lot of incoherence. There were a lot of ideological phrasings that I wouldn't have known about and others wouldn't have unless they encountered them, but also, too, a lot of jargon and also, too, a lot of scientific language that I couldn't necessarily follow. So for one of the public readings, some people who volunteered to read were some local politicians, someone who was an emissions trader, someone, you know, so a scientist. And so people like that are able to provide this kind of interpretation. And so there was an audience. And so there was a way that, you know, you could decode with other people's help in different ways some of that. And of course, some people like me were lay people. So I think this question is like, what does it mean to read it aloud? What does it mean to think about the kind of democratic potential of public speech? Mm-hmm. What are the limits of that? And I think for me also too, so there were these different documents. The summary report for policymakers are really interesting and problematic because governments were able to have line by line editing.
Yeah.
And you know, so much turns on the semantics,
right,
in terms of what's implemented and what doesn't happen. And so when you have these line by line edits, that's where like a lot of political force happens. And so I thought that maybe for people to be able to read these, they might be able to have some sense of it. And in a minor sort of key way, I think, you know, they did do that.
Does humanity suck?
I think you ask hard questions here.
It's a pretty broad question.
Congratulations, Pine Tree. But you know, I'd say, you know, humanity doesn't suck, and I'd say,
right?
But I also too that I'm developing a lot of love of animals and tide pools and also
right.
the non-humans as well,
yeah.
you know, who can't necessarily advocate for themselves as other kinds of beings. So, you know, I think a lot about Luke Cole, one of the co-founders of the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment, who said, you know, you really need to get, and I apologize again, I'm not going to quote this correctly, but about, you know, staying with the root of the problem. And, you know, I think that environments do change. I'm not advocating for species loss in any sense, but I think also too, there's a wonderful book. It's good for people to have if they feel like they don't have a good, clear grasp on questions of climate change and don't want to start reading all over the place. But I think it's called a very brief introduction to climate change. And it's produced by Oxford. They've had a number of editions and it's concise. I think it's 80 pages and part of a larger series they do. But the reason I'm mentioning it is because the edition I have has this excellent chart which shows ideas about how does nature respond to human activity. And it sets that against ideology, right? Mm-hmm. So do you believe, like, what are your beliefs and how are they informed by your worldview? And so it's good for people to look at. And of course, I reflect upon that in terms of, you know, what do I want or what are my hopes, right? Like, is it, you know, and how are those ideas about continuity based upon my own beliefs and you know, what does that mean? What does change mean in a way that's not necessarily destabilizing, destructive, or
catastrophic
okay. being a scenario.
Well, that's positive. I do feel a little more optimistic so far. I don't know how.
But continuing to have conversations is the least we can do,
yeah.
right? So, and I think, I don't know how it is for you. Like, if it's a topic for you in your everyday conversation, if you feel that you have to, if you've set aside time to talk about client, I mean, you are doing that here, right?
Yeah. I mean, like, in my, like, person-to-person, casual, everyday life.
Right.
Yeah, I feel like I do, but then I feel like because to, in my mind, it already is, like, on the road to disaster so hardcore that if I bring it up with someone, it's hard to really dive deep into it without feeling like I'm, like, sinking them into an existential crisis if
right.
I talk to them about
right.
it.
Right, right, right. So I think you're right. So the question is, like, you know, the power of the desire for continuity, right? I think I read how people don't necessarily want to be around people who talk about climate
right?
change,
yeah,
right?
It's a massive
so,
bummer.
You know, I think this, right, but I think, right, so, you know, what is it, so, but
but I
at
feel like I
time,
think about
right.
it all the time. Like, whether I'm talking about it or not, right. like, it's on, right. and it right. must be on everybody's mind, because everybody knows.
I mean, and there, you know, and I started collecting materials that were all about psychological responses to climate change. So I have a collection of papers, and I'm trying to think about trauma. Like, what does trauma look like in terms of climate change? You know, is it something that comes up in aftermath of a crisis that has to do with, you know, some kind of climate-related weather event? What are the things that prompt these feelings, and what does it mean to be able to continue to talk without having a sense of despair? Or if despair is motivating, then recognizing yeah. that as a useful, and not necessarily saying a, you know, a positivist approach, but mm-hmm. sort of being able to sit with both and also helping other people to sit with both. But then I think sitting with that is also a kind of distance position. And this has been a question for me as I make work about how I see myself or what my experience is, or is climate change elsewhere? And, you know, for me, perhaps that might have appeared to be the case when I started these projects, but it's definitely no longer so in terms of my own experience. Of course, you know, climate can't wait until everybody has experienced disaster or
right.
loss. And so I think it's a demand, and this is part of what I was thinking about when I began this project, People's Archive of Sinking and
yes,
Melting,
yeah,
a number of years ago, which is an archive of what I'm calling the future interior, asking people to contribute objects if they think that where they live may or is already becoming uninhabitable, unable to support that thing owing to climate change, whether it's sea level rise or desertification. But part of the demand of, I think, that project is to think about also too the personalization of loss, right,
right? Yeah.
Or the kind of the uneven politics of loss, mm-hmm. and this is why, you know, when you said what governments do you think are doing good work, I think, you know, this question about loss and damage, and what does loss and damage mean in terms of particular states, in terms and or even in states that aren't necessarily subject to loss and damage, what does that mean in terms of like the uneven political landscape, which is an environmental justice question.
Yeah.
So,
remember Ed Begley Jr., the actor?
Yeah.
And how he's like going full like zero emissions lifestyle where he only produces like a shoebox full of waste every month or something.
You know, I didn't know that.
Is that kind of stuff? Because there's a lot of talk about like individual change versus like pushing for like, I mean, that we need broader structural
sure,
change
sure.
to really fix the problem.
I think the question is like, what are the politics and
right.
can they work in tandem together?
Sure.
But I think, you know, this is a question that I've been asked because, in 2007, at the Venice Biennale, Gustav Metzger, who is just a wonderful, wonderful, important artist who I think is underrecognized, did a small project called Reduced Art Flights, and also had a symposium, you know, at a sort of major. I mean, and again, this is sort of, you know, it's very reflexive to the art world, but this question about like what would it mean to reduce flights and having kind of a less, you know, peripatetic, you know, uh-huh. art world, if that's the right word, or maybe it's not the right word, but
airplanes are mega carbon
however
emitters.
Yeah, so, you know, and I've been I've been asked that every time I speak, you know, people say, you know, did you fly
you took
to
a
get
plane here?
Right, and so, and I think, you know, And I think the question is, yeah, so on one hand, do I fly less and do I take trains more in public transportation? Yes, because I want to support those systems as better solutions, even though they have problems of their own. Yeah. At the same time, one of the things that I always point to is, you know, the cost, the energy cost of America's military infrastructure. And sure. I'm pointing to that. So I think this question is like, you know, what does it mean? And I wouldn't sort of weigh aviation, you know, aviation emissions versus the cost of military infrastructure, but I'd also say, why isn't that the kind of question that we're asking, yeah. right? So if you had a
derails the conversation when it's right. all about like, oh, well, what?
Right,
like,
or this, you know, this idea person? About like what? Well, this idea about like what's up for change, right? So yeah. like you couldn't like you can't really have change unless, for example, you get rid of that infrastructure,
right?
And so shouldn't that be the first question?
Do you think that they should end the dairy industry? I don't know.
You know, dairy and meat production are really problematic.
Yeah.
Methane emissions are really problematic. You know, all these kinds of concentrated farming with emissions, you know, animal production is a problem. And I did a project, it came out in 2006, and it was called Invisible Five, and it was a collaboration, and it was an audio tour of the I-5 corridor. And one of the things that we talked about were air quality issues that had to do with concentrated mega dairies
and so
that you have these, you know, you have waste pools, and yeah. then you have dairy emissions. So I think those are important questions, and they're a question about what kind of greenhouse gases are being produced. So, you know, different kinds of forestry, you know, different kinds of industrial production, you know, production of rare gases.
Yeah. Okay, remember the project you did where you were trying to get UNESCO, is that right?
Yeah.
To make the atmosphere a global heritage site?
A world heritage
yeah.
site. Yeah, exactly. I'm still working on it. Yeah.
How's it going? You got like shit tons of signatures.
Well, you know, and the project is an effort to create a clean air park in the atmosphere. And so I began that a long time ago. It was one of really the first projects I did dealing with climate change, but also, as I said, the political economy of the atmosphere, because I looked at the commodification of the atmosphere in terms of emerging greenhouse markets and how they were constructed and the politics of that, claims mm-hmm. of markets. So that was how I began that project, opening up a micro park by purchasing and withholding the right to emit certain kinds of gases, NOx or carbon dioxide in regulated emissions schemes. So sorry, that's getting pretty technical.
Cubic feet?
Yeah, you know, all that information is is available online. I don't have the specifics.
But it was the size of a number of football fields.
So, I mean, the thing is, I made a number of purchases, and there's been this desire to create a floor carbon price, but there have been these fluctuations in the market. And so over the course of the project, I made a number of purchases, and they got cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. So each time the park became exponentially larger based on the kind of bottoming out of this attempted desire to create this kind of market with a baseline price for carbon and other gases. After I did that a number of times, after I opened the park a number of times over the United States, twice and over the EU, with help from many people, because I needed those partners, and I say thank you very much to everyone. I decided that I would look at other kinds of claims, not just the claims of markets, to come in and solve climate change, but the claims of states and the problems of the COP process. And so I thought maybe looking at UNESCO, which is all about a kind of protection, right?
Yeah.
And so how does the atmosphere fall under these kinds of, you know, why would we want to protect the atmosphere, right? And what kind of categories of universal value, you know, apply to the atmosphere, you know, and you could say
all of them,
right? And so, you know, and how are existing World Heritage sites impacted by climate change?
Yeah,
they largely are. So I think this idea was that I was framing it as an umbrella. You can't really protect these others unless you protect
exactly.
the larger system that
Ooh,
they're
that's
in.
Good.
And so, but you know, there. But the process is complex, and so I went through a number of steps over a number of years, including what's called a tentative list submission, writing through all of the claims for why it should be put onto the list, listed, and I worked with a climate scientist, who I say thank you to, who helped me articulate those in the appropriate way, so it would be legitimate framing. And then I worked to get a state party because it affects all states. And I spoke to someone who had said, well, you know, it's one state can't necessarily lead it, but you need to sort of have an initiating state because all states are affected.
Right.
And then I was doing that on my own. And then I was invited to present public smog at Documenta. I thought, well, this is great. This is an exercise in soft power. I can use this as an opportunity to think about asking the German state to take a leading role. And they said no. And so I also was trying to reach out to Mohamed Nasheed of the Maldives before the coup, and was making some headway with that, but that did not go forward. And so I continued to look for a state. And for a moment during that process, it seemed as if Tonga, I got a positive response from Tonga, but that did not proceed. So I'd say what you're talking about is I decided to make a petition within the exhibition and ask people to petition their governments,
right.
And a large number of people, so 100,000 people participated in that. So
hell,
I guess
yeah,
the question, like, you know, what is that? Is it a poll? How is it different from an online poll? Is it a referendum? It's not a vote, you know? So I think the question is like, what does that mean in terms of, if there's 800,000 people that come and 1/8 do that, is that actually representative? Those were mailed to the German government, most of them, others to other states. I did receive another reply after the exhibition closed that said, thank you. It was a very condescending letter that said, thank you. We're all together on this.
oh, my God.
But, you know, and of course, there's a kind of history, you know, of artists working with air, you know, trying to understand air, trying to articulate air, looking at the value of air.
Totally.
And I think that, you know, it's also in the history of dematerialized art, I think, in that way, but also, too, trying to ask other kinds of questions that come out of the history of political and activist environmental art. And you know, would I like to succeed? You know, yes. You know, would there be significant effects of success? Yes, I mean, also you could say there are deep problems, you know, with UNESCO and that it doesn't have enforcement capability. So I think, you know, so what does that mean? And so, you know, and if you talk about one process versus the other. So I think, you know, for me, it's also about helping myself to sort of understand, you know, it would be wonderful for there to be a successful process that could operate, that could come out of international, you know, international dialogue, and it could arrest some of these ongoing emissions and shore up what needs to be done in terms of protecting us from the worst impacts of climate change.
When you started that project, were you thinking like, I'm definitely, like, I'll send it in, they'll stamp it, yes, and it'll be rock and roll.
I mean,
was part of it for you also kind of like, it's more like the symbolic is also important? I mean, those are mutually exclusive.
I began that after I started This is the Public Domain, which is a project to create a permanent public commons on land that I purchased in California. And so I guess the question is like, what are the conditions of possibility? But I guess I would say, no, I didn't think it would be a done deal. You know, no, I didn't expect it just to operate symbolically. You know, I think there are questions for me about what might happen in terms of the potential of unexpected political turns. And so I think the question is, you know, if I had just sort of put it out there as a proposition in the history of conceptual art, it wouldn't have needed to be anything more than a question.
Right.
And for me, I think, you know, when you continue to pursue something over a period of time and push against the kind of institutional processes, there's a kind of learning and things are teased out. In some ways, you know, do you learn something new? Is something new revealed? Not always. In some ways, it just, you know, might reinforce something like you're saying, you know, what did you think, right? And so I think, you know, who is it for? So I guess the thing is, like, I do some projects that you could say are more located. They're more about these kind of constructs. They help me ask questions about how do I want to live together with other people and how do we inhabit the commons that we share and depend on for survival.
We always like to ask our guests at the end of an interview if there's anything else that you would like listeners to know, like if there was something you desperately wanted to talk about and I forgot to ask about it, or if you have something coming up and you want people to like go to a thing or check a thing out or anything.
So what I'd want to say is that for people who don't know about green action and their environmental justice work in San Francisco, for example, around the toxic soil in Bayview Hunters Point, or their broader advocacy and support work across the West. I'd say, you know, please take the time to learn about them.
I'll put a link in our
show. That would be great. The other thing is that I'm also working on a project called Smog Index, where I'm asking people to contribute photographs if you have experienced a smog event and took
a
photo.
And we all have. Jesus Christ, we were living in Blade Runner there for like a month.
Yeah.
I'll send you some pics of that.
That would be great.
So please
contribute Smog Index.
Yes.
Thanks.
I'll have a link. Well, thank you so much, Amy, for coming and meeting us in this weird room.
I love this weird room.
And as always, congratulations. I'm stuck inside all day while the sun is bright and is calling my name. Okay. I hope you're pretty fired up after that interview. If you want to shoot us some feedback about that or anything you've heard on the show or anything else in your life, give us a call, 419-351-6606. Or you can tweet us at Pine Tree Podcast, or you can email us, congratulationspinetree@gmail.com. Feel free to do so. We're coming up here on our 200th episode pretty soon. What do you want us to do? We're thinking about doing some man-on-the-street interviews. We've been talking about doing it for over 4 years to just go get our thumb on the pulse of the public. What do you think about it? I don't know. If you got feedback on that, hit us up. Okay, until then, I'm just going to be wandering around aimlessly from the bridge to the other bridge to the island in between. This has been Congratulations, Pine Tree!